Hey, Rock Church. How you guys doing tonight? That was so weak. How you guys doing tonight? All right, a little better. Wow, give it up for the band, right, guys? They did such a great job. Amen. Thanks for leading us. Well, my name is Steele Crosswhite, and if you're new with us here tonight, I'm one of the four pastors here at The Rock, and tonight we're going to be continuing on in a series that we've entitled Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. And other topics too scary for church. And tonight, for those of you that know me, I'm going to be talking about a subject that is very near and dear to my heart. I'm going to be talking about rock and roll. So, to be honest with you guys, there are lots of different ways that I could have approached this subject. There are lots of different avenues and streets and different things that I could focus on when it came to the subject of rock and roll. But the more and more that I prayed about it, and the more and more I prepped for this talk, and with a tremendous amount of counsel from the pastors, I realized that the best thing that I can do in order for me to passionately communicate my heart, and even more so, even more importantly, passionately communicate God's heart when it comes to this subject of rock and roll is quite honestly just to tell you about my life. Let me give you guys just a couple of disclaimers before we get into it. I need to let you guys know that as I discuss my life and my history and my love-hate relationship when it comes to rock and roll, those of you that have known me for a little while, and you know who you are, mainly my sister and my now wife Kimberly and some of you gals like Suji and Kristen Lavallette, you understand that I have a horrible memory. And so I need to be honest with you guys as a church that when I go through the timeline of my life, there might be a month or two that I'm off in my hard timeline or even a year. Okay, so I'm being honest with you about that because the subject still applies. The events are all still real, but I might get some of my dates confused. And I just wanted to be honest with you about that because my mind's like, and sometimes I just forget stuff. Okay, so that's the first disclaimer. The second thing is that I'm going to be talking to you guys about a very real part of my life. And the truth of the matter is that I do not know how to break this subject down into about 40 minutes or so. Okay, so I'm going to be hitting some highlights of my life. I'm going to be hitting big chunks and periods in my life. And for those of you guys that are interested in some of the more details and things like that, my name and my number and my email are all on the back of your bulletin. You guys can call me. You can email me. We could set up a meeting to talk if you're interested in some of the more finite details of this story. The other thing is I need to be honest with you guys about this. Tonight, I'm going to be a little bit PG-13 maybe, okay? So if you have some kids in the room that have a sensitive disposition, I'm going to be talking about things that might make you as a parent feel a little bit uncomfortable, and I need to be honest with you about that. So if you feel like your child might be not quite ready to hear some of the more serious things of how life can affect the human heart, you may want to take your child away tonight and listen to this message online or watch it on Vimeo. I just wanted to be honest. Maybe it's not that big of a deal, but from my own conscience, I wanted to share that with you. The other thing is here, before we even get into some verses and pray, I wanted to let you guys know that because I'm talking about my life here tonight and the subject of rock and roll, I in no way whatsoever mean to make any sweeping generalizations about rock and roll, okay? That's not what my heart is. That's not what I'm here to do. So I don't want to walk away and you guys think that I'm talking about legalism or any of that kind of junk, okay? I am not trying to make any sweeping generalizations about your life either. Okay, when I approach this subject and my life in rock and roll, what I want you to focus on is that I am simply trying to give all of you guys some insight as to how quickly the human heart can be misdirected and given away. That is really the subject matter tonight, is how quickly the human heart can be misdirected and given away. And that subject applies to all of us, okay? So that's my business. Those are my disclaimers. That being said, let me show you guys to begin this talk one of my favorite Bible verses, perhaps one of the strongest verses in the Bible. This verse has convicted me. This verse has warned me. This verse has served to be a compass in my life and an anchor to my soul over the past 10 years. For those of you that know me, know that this is true. Most of you probably are aware of this verse. It's found in Proverbs chapter 4. Verse 23, above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Before you guard anything, You guard your heart. What are you giving your heart to? What are you giving your emotions to? Where is your heart leading you? Because it will take you somewhere. And the Bible says you guard it. You guard it. We're going to start with this verse and we're going to end with this verse. And my prayer is that it will become more clear in the end as to why. Let's just pray and we'll get through it here. God, thank you for tonight. Thank you that you are the heart of worship. Thank you, God, that there is nothing more real, that when the music fades and all is stripped away, Jesus Christ, you remain the object of worship through and through. Thank you that that's real. Lord, I pray that tonight that you would use me to talk to your kids that you love in a passionate way. I pray, God, that you would use your word and your spirit in me to convict, to encourage, and to challenge our hearts, Lord, to be fully devoted to you. Lord, you know that this last week, as I prepared this talk, has been tremendously difficult for me and embarrassing in lots of ways. And I pray, God, that you would give me the boldness just to lay it out on the line, really. Thank you, God, for what you've done in my life. Thank you, God, for what you're doing in this church. I say these things in your name, Jesus. Amen. So, rock and roll. Let's start at the beginning. At the very least, let's start at the beginning of rock and roll according to Steel Crosswhite and my timeline, my history. This is a picture of my dad. It really begins right here. A lot of you guys have heard me talk about my father. My father has been dead now for a little over 10 years, and you've heard me talk about him before, about how my dad was a tornado of personality. He was one of these guys that would walk into a room and somehow or another, he just commanded the attention of the room. It was contagious. He was infectious. He was charismatic. He was a tornado of a personality. And I've shared with many of you before about how I had in many ways the most amazing father and the most amazing friend a son could ever have. My father was one of my closest and to this day is probably one of my closest friends, is my closest friends that I could ever have. What you may not know about my dad is that he was also an incredible musician. And when I say musician, I don't mean that he occasionally picked up the guitar and played a G7 chord, okay? I don't mean that he just turned on the radio and occasionally listened to music. My father was a man that devoured music. He was a musician's musician. For those of you that play music in this room, you know what I'm talking about when I say that. He was the kind of musician other musicians wanted to be like. Okay, let me give you some stats of Bill Crosswhite. My pop's name was Bill. By the age of 22, my father had started his first band. My dad had performed with Elvis Presley. He'd been on TV. He'd been on the radio. He toured with the Rolling Stones. He played with the Kinks. The Kinks sang that song, Lola. La, 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 Lola. All right, okay. My dad had toured with the Kingsmen. Lua, lua, pa, pa. Oh, you guys get it, okay? My dad had played with... So, Rolling Stones, Elvis Presley, the Kinks, the Kingsmen, and I didn't know this until after my father died, but my dad wrote a song that after his death was recognized by the Rockabilly Hall of Fame, and my father was admitted into the Rockabilly Hall of Fame in Ohio. In his musical life, my father experienced some fame, some heartache, a handful of addictions that he was able, thankfully, to recover from after meeting my mom in his 30s. My father was an experienced writer. He was an experienced musician, an experienced performer, and a perfectionist when it came to music. Later in life, he chose to leave his career behind to settle down and start a family with my mom. And it wasn't until I was a teenager, late teenager, very, very early 20s, that he looked at me straight in the eye and he said, I think it was that decision to leave my band and settle down with your mother that helped me save my life. It starts and ends with my dad here in lots of ways. At the very least, it starts with my dad. I grew up in a home where I was saturated with music, that my father always played music, that even as a young boy, he is who I idolized and his experiences that I heard about. Like I said, I have to jump around a bit because we don't have a lot of time, but let's fast forward a little bit, okay? The year would have been 1982. I would have been 4 years old. My family settled down in Utah from Colorado, and by this time, my parents recognized that unlike my other siblings, I had no interest in anything outside of music. I was a horrible, and still am, horrible athlete. I'm completely uncoordinated, but like my son Jet, those of you that know him, I was a bundle of energy. And even at a young age, my life was consumed with music. I remember walking up the stairs to my parents' house and sneaking into my father's closet and pulling out from underneath his clothes this guitar case that when you opened it revealed the 1963 Fender Jazzmaster guitar that was road-wearied, had cigarette burns on it, was scarred because it had been touring across the country and the world. I have a picture of that guitar. It's mine now. I would sneak upstairs, and as a four-year-old, I would grab that guitar case, and I would open it up, and it would smell like cigarettes and rock and roll. And I remember I strummed those strings, and I just wanted to hear the hum of that guitar. I loved music at 4 years old. Naturally, my parents saw in me this desire for music, and they began teaching me how to sing. Now, I should say this. I'm a parent now. I get it. All kids love to sing. It's a wonderful thing. They just don't care. They don't have any shame, all right? They just love to sing. But I should mention to you that my parents told me later that I loved to sing so much that as a four-year-old, when my mom started to sing, and she wouldn't mind me if I told you this, her voice is so bad. It's the worst thing you've ever heard. It's like gravel and cats, man. It's like, blarg, tharg and arg, okay? God bless my mom, okay? But she has a bad voice. And as a four-year-old, my mom said that I would run over, okay, when she started to sing, whatever, Itsy Bitsy Spider, I don't care, and just put my fingers on her mouth and say, no sing, mommy. It's the kid version of shut it down. All right? I loved to sing. I loved music. Also at this young age, my dad had it in him to teach me how to perform. I'll never forget him coming up to my room and bringing me downstairs into the living room when we had dinner guests over, and he would wrap this turquoise blue scarf around my neck, and he'd have me sing Blue Suede Shoes to the dinner guests. I was four. Performance and music was in my blood. I loved it. By age five, 1 year later, I had won my first talent show. I was in kindergarten. I played two songs. The first one was a song my dad wrote called Chicky Wah Wah. Pretty cool. The other one was the same Blue Suede Shoes that he had taught me from Elvis Presley. My dad came up on stage and he played the guitar and I held the microphone. I'll never forget them coaching me to move my shoulder like this so I could, quote, woo the crowd. I won that talent show as a five-year-old out of the whole school, which at that time was a pretty big deal. I competed against the sixth grader who was Billy Idol. Beat him down, baby. And I'll never forget it because what happened next as a five-year-old, guys, this is no lie, this is my life story, was my first real rock and roll moment. After I won that talent show as a five-year-old, the principal announced to the school that I was the winner. And I walked outside. It was either for recess or it was because I was going home or whatever. I don't really remember. But I was literally mobbed by a group of girls. I was 5 years old. And at the time, I think they were sixth graders, which is a pretty big deal. Okay. These girls, listen, they were so nuts that they ripped my shirt. They ripped, yes, listen carefully. They ripped my shirt. They ripped the gold necklace that was on my neck off. And they scratched my chest so badly that we had to go to the principal's office to find out what happened. And you may not believe that I dress like that, so I brought some family fun pictures of when I was a kid. There's me as Elton John. Those are heart-shaped sunglasses. That's me doing Blue Suede Shoes. Yes, I've always worn aviators. Here on the bottom there, if you can see it, in that white shirt and that black shirt, that's when I won that talent show, when I was just 5 years old. And you can't really see it on this picture, but yeah, there's a little gold chain there, okay? That's the one they ripped off. At 5 years old, guys, I was hooked. Performance and rock and roll was in my blood. And even at a young age, I knew what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I loved to perform. I loved to have an audience. I loved music. I wasn't good at all that other stuff as a kid. I wasn't interested in that other stuff as a kid. I wanted to be Elton John and Elvis Presley. I have to skip around a lot because of the sake of time, but I can tell you this, guys, that the next 8 years of my life were spent in a musical cloud of rock star worship. That's what it was. I was absolutely consumed with Elvis Presley, the Beatles, Michael Jackson, Guns N' Roses, Queen, Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix, The Doors, The Who, Van Halen, U2, Motley Crue, Twisted Sister, Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Robert Johnson, John Coltrane, Crosby, Stills & Nash, and Young, The Allman Brothers, and Pink Floyd, just to name a few. I loved their music. Side note, this is just a tangent here, but at age 8, I wanted to be a rock star so bad that I begged my parents to buy me the Angus Young cap that was leather, studded with beads, and give me the, you know, the cool bracelets, the spike bracelets, and awesome gloves. Let me just show you. I'm 8 years old in these shots. I don't know how old I am. I had the zipper jacket. I had the MJ club. Okay. I asked my parents to take me to the mall so I could walk around and look cool. I'm not kidding. It wasn't Halloween. It was a Tuesday. Okay? It's like, let's go to the mall. I want to walk around. Later in life, my mom told me that my parents, they walked behind me just to distance themselves from the crazy young boy walking with a strut. Needless to say, music is what I adored. I did. I adored it. Music is what I understood. And rock and roll, even at a young age, is truly, truly, truly what I worshipped. I'll never forget practicing how to dance like Axl Rose using a hockey stick in front of the mirror. My parents bought me a hockey stick in hopes to get me into sports. I turned it into a microphone and put scarves on it. I walked around the block with a radio back then. We called them ghetto blasters. You know what I'm talking about. I walked around the block with a ghetto blaster on my shoulder, rocking at the loudest volume I can stand to Motley Crue's Shout at the Devil, much to the dismay of my terrified mother. To all the neighbors, shout at the devil! 10 years old? How old am I? I don't know. Too young to be doing that, probably. At age 10, I was given an electric guitar that had to be red and white because it needed to look like Eddie Van Halen's from 5150, okay? I wouldn't know how to play it. I'd sit on the back patio. I'd turn up my crate amplifier as loud as I could, and just so I can get some feedback, and smack my arms on it and hands on it so it would go. By age 15, I had actually learned how to play the guitar. And truthfully, guys, I have no way of saying this without sounding a little bit proud, but the truth was I excelled at it. I understood the guitar. I loved the guitar. I loved everything about the guitar at age 15. I loved the way it felt. I loved the way it smelled. I loved the way it sat in my lap. I loved the way it looked when it hung around my neck. And I loved more than anything that there was an instrument that I could play when I played it right would perfectly convey the emotion that was in my heart. And it still does that to this day. And at 15, as I started to play guitar, I was consumed once again by the rock gods of Jimmy Page, Jimi Hendrix, Jeff Beck, George Harrison, Roger Waters, Robert Johnson, Neil Young, and Slash. And I began to take on their styles and their identities. That's an important thing, their style and identity. And whenever somebody would say, I'm a fan of one of these bands, I would quickly shut them down and make sure that they knew that I was an even greater fan. I would be at a party and somebody would say, yeah, I like Led Zeppelin. You might like Led Zeppelin. Some might love Led Zeppelin. Some might adore Led Zeppelin. And then there's me. And that was real. I would actually say that. There was, in this time of my life, no greater fan, no greater historian when it came to any of these musicians. I knew all about it. I watched the videos, listened to the records, read the books. I was the greatest fan. I was adapting to their personalities. I was taking on their identity. I was a rock star too, at least in my mind. And I thought to myself, even back then, at that young age, one day, they're all going to be talking about Steel Cross White too. In my blood, in my heart. I should mention to you guys this as well, and again, forgive me that some of the details might overlap with my memory, but when I was about age 12, my older sister Paige, some of you know her, she goes to this church, she began talking to me about this guy. She began talking to me about this guy, this God named Jesus Christ. I grew up in Utah, so certainly I'd heard of Jesus Christ. But because my parents smoked and my parents drank, and by this age I was smoking too, all I knew was that Jesus probably wanted nothing to do with me. Okay, at age 12. That being said, my sister Paige, she took me to church. She took my parents to church. They followed, my family followed. And for a few years, I need to be honest about this, I really tried to understand Jesus. And in fact, I would go so far to say that even at that young age, I loved Jesus. And I did. I mean, I went to camps. I played music in the church. I had a Bible. I even told people that I was a Christian. But this is important, what I'm going to say to you next. Though Jesus may have been my God at this age, he certainly was not who I worshiped. Music is what satisfied me. Music is what consumed me. Rock and roll, not Jesus. Rock and roll was my identity. That's what I wanted to be known for, you see? Had I had a chance to play music, listen to music, learn about music, watch something about music, or go to church or read my Bible or learn about Jesus, music would win every single time. Fast forwarding just a little bit, by 17, I started my first real band. By then, the missing elements were coming together. I had learned how to play the electric guitar. I had written some songs. I loved performing. I got a drummer. I got a bass player. I got a keyboard player. At that time, because my dad had been my friend, because my dad's history of music, because my dad's understanding of business, as a 17-year-old boy, I went to my father and I asked him if he would manage our band. And my dad, of course, jumped at the position. He was readily ready to take that position, but he said to me, "I will be the manager of the band as long as you do things my way." I said, "That's fine." In my mind, I should say that I pictured that I would be an overnight success. I had in my mind that I finally had a band, I was going to play all kinds of concerts, and I was going to be an overnight huge smash because we had my dad as our manager. But instead of playing shows right away, instead of an overnight success, my dad being the manager of our band, he made us practice in his basement at least 4 times a week for over a year. For over a year. For hours upon hours upon hours. Every time that we wanted to play a show, my dad would say, "No, you're not ready." Time and time again, he would walk down the stairs of the house and he would tell us just what was great about a song and just what was sucky about the song. My father, as a manager, as a musician, as a perfectionist, was relentless in making sure that his son and his band was tight. My father would record our practices so we could listen to them. He would film our practices, and then after the practice, he would make us watch the practice. Time and time again, he would coach us in what was right and what was wrong. He would come down the stairs and he would tell me and look me in the eye in front of the entire band and he would say, "Steele, if you are going to be a rock star, you cannot turn 12 songs into one long song. You're going to ruin 12 songs instead of writing one great one. Learn to write a hook. Learn to make the song interesting. Steele, nobody cares about whether or not it's musically great. Nobody cares how interesting it is in all of your time signatures. Nobody cares. They just want to be moved by something. They want to believe something. You learn how to write a song that will move them, and you've got the world. You'll be a rock star then." He would make us watch videos of Led Zeppelin and The Who and Elvis, and then he would show us, after a band practice, the marriage between great performance and great songs. If you're paying attention right now, in many ways, I was again being groomed to be a rock star. Behind the scenes, my father had been meeting at that time while we're practicing in the basement. My dad was beating the streets, meeting every club owner, every radio station promoter, every campus director, walking out to them, introducing himself to them, saying to them, "Wait till you hear the next, quote, great band." My dad made contacts with record companies and managers in California and New York City. Before I knew it, there was a buzz in Salt Lake City about this young band before we even played a show. He was a master of marketing. Our second show, our second concert that we've ever played, you've heard me share this maybe before, we opened up for the then famous band Eve 6. Maybe you don't like that band, but back then they were pretty big. They were kind of the suckier version of Green Day, okay? So Eve 6 came into town. It was our second concert, and I opened up for over 1,000 people. 1,000 people. My second concert. Our 20th concert that we played as a band was in front of a man, and you're not going to know this name. Maybe one person in this room is going to know this name. We played in front of a guy named Mike Klink. Now, you don't know that name, but you know this name. Guns N' Roses. Metallica. Mike Klink produced Appetite for Destruction, Use Your Illusion 1, Use Your Illusion 2, Patience, Kill 'Em All, Injustice for All, Master of Puppets. He was the producer of those bands, of those albums, and he heard about our band by our 20th show and came out and saw us on his own dime. I don't even know how to say this without sounding proud, but the truth was that in less than 2 years, our band was selling out every club that we stepped into. We won every stupid local award for best new band, best new song, best guitar player, best performer. At one point, I won best rock mandolin player. I played one chord on the mandolin. People were just handing out awards. suck at the mandolin. At some point, we're on the cover of every local magazine, we are on every local TV station, and we are being played on every local rock radio station. My dad made a habit. He took me with him one time. He would go into a club and he would ask for the owner of the club. The owner of the club would walk out. My dad would be dressed up to the nines. He'd have a suit, and a tie on. He'd have his gold chains on and such. He'd be smoking a Pall Mall. And he'd say to him, "Hey, let me ask you a question. What's the highest amount of money you've ever paid a band to come here and play at your club?" I'd say, "Well, we paid him this amount of money." My dad said, "Good, good, good. We'll play for $1 more." "Okay. Okay." That's how he did it. By age 20, 20 years old, we'd recorded 3 albums and had sold over 10,000 records. Not bad for a local band. Okay, here's what's happening behind the scenes. Drinking. Lots and lots of drinking on my part. Never on stage, because being drunk on stage wasn't professional and my dad wouldn't allow it. But afterwards, man, afterwards, we'd go to party after party, lots and lots of parties, mainly with people that I didn't know, mainly so I could hook up with girls that I wouldn't remember, mainly so I can get free booze. And in my mind, I'm a rock star, baby. This is what rock stars did. At least I'm a local rock star. Maybe some of you in this room would say, "Listen, you're 20 years old. That was normal for your age. You're a 20-year-old guy. That's what 20-year-olds do." Maybe for some, maybe that's what 20-year-olds do, but I should add this to you. My first time that I ever had a drink was at age 16. I got drunk that night, and I had never in my life had a drink of alcohol without ending up wasted. The other thing is that for those of you that know me, given my personality, I only know how to do things one way. I mean, I'm an extremist. I'm either all in or I'm all out. I don't know how to do this word that people call balance. It is constantly refining me. In my life today, even today, talking with my wife, I'm an extreme. I will go, baby. I will burn. That's how God wired me. He's teaching me now by his grace how to get tempered a little bit. You combine that personality at 20 years old with endless popularity, free booze, tons of girls, and a band, you have some dangerous combinations. Let me make one point here real quick, because some of you are listening to this, and you're going to start to hear some of the negative things that I've done in my life and the poor choices that I've made in my life. And you're going to wonder, you're going to be tempted to wonder, what about his parents? What about this dad of his? What about this mom of his? I need to just be very clear and be on record in saying this. I need to let you know that there have never been two people in my life outside of my wife who have loved me more than my parents. Every single person in this room has the ability to blame shift. But I want you to know something. I knew what I was doing, and I knew that what I was doing was wrong. And I need to add this as well. My mom has helped me through some of the darkest times of my life. I called her today, and I told her I was going to be giving this message. She said she will support me, and she'll be at church with me tomorrow. I think I just need to let you guys know this, because I want you to know that despite my poor choices, I adore my family. I adored my parents. And many times now, as I've grown as a man, when I look back at these times in my life, I see so much more clearly that in many ways, my parents were really trying to guide a rocket that had already taken off. I was already going somewhere. I was already heading down a road. Even my dad being our manager, I can see him now holding on to me. Let me fast forward to June of 2000. There was a conference in Las Vegas. It was called EDM, Emerging Artists and Talent in Music. It was a lot like, for those of you guys that are musicians or kind of pop culture folks, you know what South by Southwest is? It's in Austin, Texas. EDM is kind of like that, but it's a bit more focused and it was a little smaller. It was in Las Vegas. The conference was filled with music execs, managers, bands, workshops, and entertainment attorneys. EDM, the showcase, was the who's who of who's in music. And to be a part of this showcase, your band had to be selected. And if you were selected, it provided opportunities for you to make contacts with some of these people to help further your career. Like I said, it was a musical showcase. You would play for some of these guys in hopes that you might make it big. At this time of this conference, I was 21 years old. Now listen, my dad being our band manager, he sent our band to Las Vegas 5 days before the showcase. Again, the reason was so that he could create a buzz in Las Vegas about our band. He was a master of marketing. So he got lanyards made, and he made posters, and he got matchbooks made, and beer cups made, and anything that he could put our band name on, he got it made so that we can build a name for ourselves before the showcase even began. He organized street teams so that Las Vegas was plastered with our pictures. By the time the conference even began, Las Vegas was littered with paraphernalia promoting our band. By the time, listen to this, by the time the evening ceremonies even kicked off, my dad had made contact with the managers of the Cranberries, Nine Inch Nails, and Marilyn Manson. And you may not like those bands, but my dad was smart enough to know what was happening in music at time, and so he went, okay, Marilyn Manson with the Dope Show, I know what's going on, Trent Reznor with Nine Inch Nails, I know what's happening here, and the Cranberries with that stupid zombie song. I'm going to go find out those guys, and I'm going to meet their managers. And so before the conference even began, he had meetings set up with these people. Our band had a showcase. It was slotted in the best place at the Hard Rock Cafe. There's a club there called The Joint. By far, it was the coolest place to play back then. We had the perfect time slot. It was 7 o'clock p.m. on Friday night, June 9th. It was perfect. It was set. Our band was ready. And in many ways, guys, this is the truth. It was our big break. My dad had networked with everyone he could, and he had set the stage for us, and all we had to do was play. Now, June 8th. The night before our showcase, the night before our band was scheduled to play, you guys have heard me talk about this before, but my dad died suddenly of an abdominal aortic aneurysm. And I really don't have time to discuss the details, guys. We don't have time tonight, but I can tell you this, that the most haunting memories of my life, the most troubling memories of my life were of the 10 hours that led up to his death. I watched my grown father suffer in excruciating pain. I watched him cry like a baby, without care, without help, only to die. And by far, in all seriousness, these are the hardest memories for me to shake. Even now, I wake up in the middle of the night in cold sweats. You can ask my wife. Even now, a couple of times a week, there are jacked up memories about this time in my life. To watch a man that in many ways that I had idolized, many ways that I put on this pedestal, to watch him suffer, to drag him to the bathroom so he doesn't mess himself, to watch himself cry out in agony, weeping for hours on hours, it changed me, man. That jacked me up. Only to have him die. Now, you think about this for a second. It made me wonder, at that time in my life, could I have done something different? What if I had yelled at the doctor louder? What if I had knocked out that nurse? What if I would have called the ambulance? What if we weren't in Nevada? You know, the reason we're in Nevada away from a different hospital is because of my band. The first thing I did when my dad died, the very first thing, I didn't call my sister, I didn't call my brothers, I didn't call my band. I went to a bar, I downed a bottle of bourbon as fast as I could, all by myself. It was the most defining moment in my life. You see, the thing is that what my dad's death did to me was somehow cement and pervert the idea in my mind that I was born to be a rock star. You see, his death jacked me up a bit. It's almost as if I thought, everything that I've lived for, all of those performances, all of those talent shows, all of that coaching, all of that training, all of those times that we listened to those musics, all of those times that we went and visited those bands, everything is in vain unless you somehow made it. You were groomed for this. My father, I would wake up every single morning and he wouldn't say, hey son, hey Steel. My dad would greet me like this, hey rock star. That gets cemented into your brain when you watch a man suffer and die, and it perverted everything. The next night came, the night of our showcase. I was all over the place. We decided to play it. It was one of those things in my mind we did for Dad. You were groomed for this. You were born to be a rock star. If you don't somehow do it, Steele, his life is in vain. I had this weird idea in my head that somehow he died for me to do this. The Hard Rock was filled with people. There was a buzz about the fact that the band's manager died because my dad had networked with all these people. Even the owner of Edom Conference herself came to our show. We played that concert. It was an absolute whirlwind. The next thing you know, we were bombarded with contacts. Bombarded. We suddenly had meetings with managers and attorneys and booking agents. It was overwhelming. Overnight, literally overnight, I was handed the world. I should mention to you guys that all of this, again, happened the night after my dad died. My head was not on straight. The last thing that I needed was more opportunity. In a matter of months, In just months, there was a bidding war for our band. We met with Sony, we met with Island, we met with Def Jam and Redline Records. We talked to producers of Matchbox 20 and Creed and Lifehouse and Bob Dylan. We ended up signing with the record company that signed the Black Crowes, Prince, and Pete Townsend from The Who. We had made it. In my mind, this was it. We were on the cover of Salt Lake Tribune and The Hollywood Reporter. The Hollywood Reporter has this quote: "This band is going to be a multi-Grammy award-winning band, the best band to hit the scene in 25 years. We flew out to record our album. We spent months in Indiana, Los Angeles, Canada. I rubbed elbows with famous people. I hung out with members of Guns N' Roses, the singer of Nickelback, John Mellencamp. For those of you guys that are drummers in this room, Kenny Aronoff, he's one of the best drummers in the world. He played on my record. We released our record, and in 1 week, we went to number one. In 1 week, we were on number one of the Billboard charts. I was a rock star. I played shows with the Foo Fighters, Maroon 5, Sheryl Crow, Tonic, Third Eye Blind, Cheap Trick, Five for Fighting, Howie Day, Train, on and on. I partied with the dudes from Ruby Horse, OAR. I hung out with Marcy Playground. I spilled beer on Gwyneth Paltrow's chest. I hung out with Stevie Nicks from Fleetwood Mac. I had a tour bus, a road manager, a band manager, a business manager, two entertainment attorneys, a booking agent, a press agent, and a record company. I had a $150,000 signing bonus, a $350,000 record, and a promised advance of $500,000 for my next piece of publishing. I was barely 22. Barely 22. Now, here's what was happening behind the scenes. By this time, I'd contracted three separate sexually transmitted diseases. I'd spent more hours than I can count in strip clubs, and I made a habit out of waking up in places that I did not recognize. I smoked three packs of cigarettes a day. I chewed in between. I ballooned my weight to 240 pounds, and I drank myself drunk. For those of you that knew me then, for at least 2.5 years straight, there wasn't a night that I wasn't wasted. To diet, quote, diet, I quit eating food so that I could still have the same amount of calories I would need so I could lose weight and still have 17 beers a night. When I was home, I remember waking up in my dad's bedroom closet wrapped up in his clothes. I remember waking up on the foot of my mom's bed. She was rubbing my head at 3 a.m. I'd wake up in people's bedrooms and would not know what happened the night before. I got in a fight with a dude in Los Angeles because I was just, quote, making out with his prostitute. I got in a fight with my manager because we only sold 25,000 records in 1 week. I fired my entertainment attorney, then fired my manager, then called the head of the record company at 21 years old and asked him what he was doing to help me with my career. I was out of control. I would wake up with my clothes on in the shower with puke all over myself. This is hilarious, but pathetic. One time I woke up on the bedroom floor with no pants on, a suit blazer on, and a half-eaten ham sandwich in my hand. I was a rock star. I followed the dream. Listen to what I'm going to say here because it's very important. I wrapped my identity into it. I gave my heart over to it. It no longer had anything to do with music or anything to do with passion or anything to do with art or creativity. It was about my identity now. And that's what you do. That's where it goes. And something changed that fall. I was off tour for about a month. I had been gone for almost 5 months. I felt completely out of sorts being at home. It's really weird for those of you guys that have had a job where you traveled, or for some of you touring musicians that have spent time on the road, it is weird to be on a bus for 5 months, drop your laundry off at the production office, wake up in the morning and have a case of beer sitting at your bus, get cigarettes for free, food for free, laundry done, and then come home and be like, wait, what? I felt completely out of sorts. And I should also tell you that I was absolutely miserable. I mean it. I was miserable. It is true that my career had taken off. It was true that I was heading down that road. I was on the cover of R&R magazine, and they were quoted as saying that my band was beating out Train's Drops of Jupiter. My career was taking off, but I had absolutely no idea who I was anymore. I came home, and I remember looking at my sister and my mom, and I was ashamed. I was ashamed of who I'd become. I was disgusted by my language. It was filthy. My heart, my habits, my perverted, wicked thoughts. I remember sitting at the kitchen table going, something has to be more than this. There's got to be more than this. While being at home, my sister Paige, she invited me to this small church called The Rock Church. At the time, there was maybe 20 people, 30 people. Didn't meet at this building. Prior to this, I had met this man named Bill Young. You guys know him as one of our four pastors. Bill Young was actually the guy that performed or officiated my dad's funeral. I remember thinking, this guy is real and down to earth. That being said, when my sister invited me to church, I wanted nothing to do with it. Nothing. I wanted nothing to do with Jesus. I was consumed. I was ruined by guilt. And I felt way more comfortable in a strip club, way more comfortable in a bar. One day, my sister, she got smart. She told me that if I went to church, then afterwards, we'd all go out drinking together. And by the way, I'll buy your beers. That's what she said. She said, they also don't care if you go to this church and if you smoke cigarettes. And I thought to myself, a church that doesn't care that I smoke and the promise of beers afterwards, I will go to this church. So reluctantly, I went. I do not remember, guys, at this time, this is honest, I do not remember what was spoken on, I don't remember what songs were sung, and to be honest, I really don't remember what the church even looked like, because like I said, it wasn't in this building. What I remember is that I was loved. Sounds kind of stupid, I know. I just remember that I was loved. I remember that nobody could give a rip that I was coming off a cool tour. Nobody cared that I was on MTV. Nobody cared that I was on VH1. Nobody cared that I was featured in the Rolling Stone. All they cared about was that I was here and that maybe I'd learn a little bit about Jesus. For years, I had built up this identity in music. For years, I was known for music. I was known for my talent. I was known for performance. But in a matter of seconds, I walked into this church and I was only known as this long-haired guy that stunk like leather and cigarettes trying to find out more about Jesus. These people, they loved me and they could care less about my paper-thin identity of being a, quote, rock star. And because I had some time to kill, because I was off tour for about a month, I spent every waking moment I could with some of these people because I was fascinated that they didn't care. I was hanging out every night with my sister Paige and my now wife Kim and Suji Singh and Joey Henderson and Becky Porter and Becky Lawson and Kristen Lavalette and some of you guys that I don't have time to mention. I started meeting with Bill Young, the pastor of this church, at Rich's Bagel at 8:30 in the morning, which I thought was like the most ungodly time of day. Like, why are we meeting at 8:30? And I'd get up, I'd drag myself there, and we'd talk about Jesus and about grace and about relationship with Jesus and about music. And many, many times I would tell Bill and share with him some of the things that I had done, some of the things that I was feeling, some of the things that had happened in my life, only to be met with love and grace and understanding that comes from Jesus. I would hang out with Bill in the mornings and Paige and those girls at night, and it was like I was hearing about Jesus Christ for the first time ever. I had a whole new understanding of God's love, of God's grace, and how he actually delights in me. It was life-changing in less than a month. I had been home for about a month, and I got a call from our record company. We were supposed to go out on tour in October with the bands Lifehouse and Chris Robinson from the Black Crowes. So get ready for that tour. I said, okay. We also had an opportunity, because we were at home, to open up for the band The Counting Crows. You guys might know them. They were playing up at the UVU Stadium, and it was a great show. We had an opportunity to open up in front of 16,000 people. And by this time in my life, my friendships were changing. In a small amount of time, I didn't care as much about rock and roll. I knew I was different. I cared that I was different. I cared that there was something new. The rock and roll mentality did not define me. It did not seem to matter as much. Now listen, don't get me wrong. Don't misunderstand me. I loved music. I adored music. But the flimsy, fake mentality of being a musician, of being a rock star, suddenly I didn't care about. And because I had been home for about a month, because I was hanging out with some of these people from church, and I had this opportunity to open up for the Counting Crows at UVU Stadium, I had some backstage passes, and it made sense to me to give these backstage passes to some of my church friends. One of those people was Bill Young, the pastor of this church. I played the concert. It went great. I should say this. If one of the most defining moments of my life in my early 20s was the day that my father died, the next most defining moment of my life came right after this concert was played. Because I remember Bill Young coming into the dressing room. He gave me a huge hug, and I looked at him, and I said, hey, what'd you think of the music? He looked at me, and he said, I love the music. You guys did great. But then Bill said something to me that will change my life and has changed my life forever. Bill looked at me in the eye and he said, Steele, can I tell you what I was thinking? I said, yeah. He said, when you were smiling on stage tonight in front of all those people, all I could think of was this. What if this kid was playing just like this with all of this passion and all of this zeal and all of this energy inside of the local church? Guys, have you seen The Matrix? Do you remember when the main character, Neo, he takes one of the pills and suddenly his eyes are open to what was real and what was a lie? Or when Morpheus looked at him and he said, welcome to the first day of the rest of your life? This is exactly what that moment was like for me. I mean, I'm not kidding. When Bill mentioned to me the idea of playing real rock and roll inside of a local church, it's as if my eyes were open for the first time. I'll never forget it. It was like I was hearing what I was meant to do. Yes, play music. Yes, love rock and roll. Yes, love performance, but do it for Jesus and do it inside the focus of a local church. It was like water to me. And for the sake of time, again, you can talk to me more about it later because there's a lot I can't cover. I can't get into the details of how much God changed my life over the next several years, but I can tell you this. Whereas before my identity had been built into the idea and the image of somehow being this rock star, my identity was now in Jesus Christ and who he made me to be. Whereas before my heart had been given to music and given to fame and given to glory, now my heart had been given over to Jesus Christ who forgave me, who loved me, and who made me and took delight in me. And over the scope of those few years, I learned to pray, and I learned to read, and I learned to love this church. I quit drinking. I quit smoking. I lost 88 pounds. I went to every woman that I could remember. Every woman that I could remember being with in a sexual, immoral way, and I remember asking for their forgiveness. I quit living an image. I quit lying about how popular I was. I quit going to bars to get drunk. I quit telling people about what an amazing musician I was. Here's the gist. I quit my band to play music in a local church. Because God had changed me. Because God understood my heart. I started loving what he loved. Let me tell you this. Jesus Christ loves people. Jesus Christ loves this church. Jesus Christ gave his life for all of you. And because I want to love what he loves, I will give my entire life to serving those that Jesus came to serve and love. And that's all of you. I need to end with the same verse that I began with. Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Guard your heart, for it's the wellspring of life. Every person here needs to understand that Jesus Christ did not take music from me. Jesus is the author of music. He is the maker of melody. He is the source of all perfect tone. He is the writer of the pocket. Here's the big idea. Jesus Christ made you. God made you, man or woman. God formed you in your mother's womb. He knit you together. He placed in you those talents, those desires, those dreams, those gifts, those passions, those abilities. God made you. He is the author and the source of your life. And he is the author and the source of all that is good. And because he made you and he breathed life into you and he is the giver of all gifts, he is the only one that is owed our allegiance and our worship. God says this in Jeremiah 9. He says, let him who boasts boast about this, that he understands and knows me, that I am the Lord who exercises kindness, justice, and righteousness on earth. For in these things I delight. What are you boasting in? He says, if you're going to boast of anything, boast that you know me. Boast that I made you. Boast that I'm good. Boast that I'm kind and just and righteous, and I delight in those things. You boast in me. You give your heart to me. Or Jesus said it like this, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your mind, and with all of your strength. He is the source of everything. He is the source of your life. He is the author of all things good. And he says, then therefore I am due your heart. You guys need to understand this. You need to get this into your mind. When our hearts are given over to the gift and not the giver, When we worship an identity, when we worship a gift, when we worship an idea, we end up alone and frustrated and unfulfilled. When our identity is placed in anything other than Jesus Christ, anything other than Jesus, we are lost at sea. We have no anchor, no direction, no purpose. We wait, hoping for land, waiting for hope. If he is not the source of who you are, if he is not the anchor of who you are, you're lost. You are lost. Jesus Christ is the desire of my heart. He is the author of my identity. He is the reason that I play music today. He is the vision inside the idea of having amazing rock and roll inside of a local church. He is my compass, my anchor, my hope, my guide, and my purpose. I see everything through the lens of Jesus anymore. Everything through his lens. Everything through that compass. Everything through the vision of Christ, because he's the source of all things good. So let me ask you just a couple of questions and then we're going to end. Difficult, but needed. What have you given your heart to? Where does your identity lie? What or who do you worship? And are you fulfilled yet? What have you given your heart over to? Where does your identity lie? Here's an easy way to answer that. What do you want to be known for? I want to be known for loving Jesus. What do you want to be known for? Where is your identity? Is it in your sex appeal? Is it in your money? Is it in your talent? Is it in your hobby? Is it in your gift? What do you worship? You can answer that question by saying this. What do I spend most of my time thinking and dreaming about? And the question is this. Are you fulfilled? Are you fulfilled yet? You know what the most perverted thing is about addiction? I could say this because I know. The most perverted thing about addiction is that the addict actually thinks that the next fix is going to fix it. Are you fulfilled yet? Listen to me. You need Jesus Christ. You need to know that he came because he loves you, that he died on the cross because he loves you, and that however your heart beats, whatever it is that makes you tick, he placed it there. And when you worship Jesus over the gift, when you worship the giver over the gift, when your identity is in Jesus and not your talent, not your money, not your fame, not your service, and not your thing, you will be given because of Christ life and life to the full. That is real. It's not prosperity. That's not what I'm talking about. But you'll be given life. Streams of living water. Jesus said it. He said, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. Christ says, I came that they may have life and life abundantly. When we yield our life to the identity of Christ, he gives it back. He gives you real life. When we do not place our hope, our identity in Jesus, when we place it in anything else, we are lost. We are lost and we are headed nowhere but hell. Literally. But when we worship Jesus, when he is our identity, when he is the author of all things that we see, there's life. That's me and my boy. He's a crazy cool drummer. I'm going to take the best parts of everything that my dad taught me, and I'm going to teach it to that young man. And I'm going to teach it to him with focus! An eternal perspective. And there's my beautiful, brown-eyed, gorgeous, too sexy to be true wife. And there's my baby girl that nobody will ever touch. God gives me life. I never had this in store for me. I never wanted that. I never did that. God also never took music from me. I love tone. I love passion. I love music. I love watching people give everything on stage. I love watching drummers play in the pocket when their jaw gets tight. I love watching teenagers discover Jimmy Page as if he's something new. I love hearing the E chord. I love the E chord. I love open strings on the guitar. I love the endless possibilities of scales. I love music. I love it. But you know what I love more? I love Jesus more. I love Jesus Christ, and I love that there is a God who made music, who understands music, and who understands that I love everything about it. I love that when my identity is in Christ and my heart is given over to Christ, He does not take music away from me. He gives it back, and He gives it purpose, and He gives it vision, and He gives it legacy. The last thing this world needs is another fan of some bullcrap band. We need more Christians. We need more people to know about Jesus. And I'm going to use music and every piece that I got in my body to tell people about it. He gives it back. Whatever it is that you have placed your identity in, whatever it is that you worship apart from Jesus, it will rust, it will fade. But with Him and through Him, we will have a wellspring of life. Listen to me. Turn to Jesus Christ tonight. Come to Him who loves you. Come to Him who saved you from hell, and hide your identity in Him. He is the author of all things right. He is the author of all things good. Come to Jesus because He came to you first. God so loved you that He gave His one and only Son, that whoever believes in Him will not perish, but have eternal life. Life in heaven and life right now by the power of the Holy Spirit. When you walk in Christ, when you say, I am a sinner, I have jacked it up, my identity is blown out of proportion, and everything but you, Jesus, you died on the cross for me, you come into my life, I accept that I am a sinner and that I need you. At that moment, life begins. Real life begins. For those of you that know me, you know that I spent 25 years of my life with rock and roll as my God. As my God. I mean, I worshiped it. I worshiped it. I wanted it. And those of you that know me now, you know that rock and roll is my slave. I am not mastered by it. I will master it. It is a drug that will not win. And I am here to tell you guys tonight that there is more. His name is Jesus Christ, and He has set me free. He has washed me of vanity, narcissism, addiction, and rusting, ever-fading spotlights. And said, you're mine. You're mine. I am who defines you. You are good because I said so. You are worthy because I made you so. I delight in you. Don't listen to anybody else. You're mine. Come to Jesus tonight. You ask yourself, are you free? Are you really? Are you really? For those of you that do not know Jesus, I'll be standing back there at the Connections booth, and so will some other people that are just like you and me. That have walked into this relationship with Christ, please come talk with us. Please come say hi. You know, even if you don't know what's next, just come say hi. Okay? For those of you guys that are already Christians, ask yourself, are you worshiping Him? Is your identity in Him? Is your heart given to Him? Are you fulfilled? I love you guys. I love you guys. Thanks for letting me, I mean this. Thanks for letting me be honest with you guys tonight. It's super embarrassing. Thank you to Jesus. Let's just pray. God, thank you for tonight. God, I don't really even know what to say. I don't. I know that I love you. I know that you've changed me. I know, Lord, that you have the ability. My story is not the worst, God, by any means. There are men and women in this church that have been saved from so much more of the fires of this life and the fires of hell. There are men and women that have a more checkered story than I could ever even imagine. But the point is, God, is that you would save all of us. That Jesus Christ, that you wash us clean, that you say, let me be an anchor to your soul. Let me truly, truly guide your life. The good things that you've done, let me make them better because you'll do it for me. The bad things that you've done, let me wash them away so that you can have a new life and be a new creation in me. Help those people.